From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. If you're feeling a little hungover, kind of jet-lagged today, you're not alone, and you may be able to blame it on the fact that we set our clocks back this weekend. Later this hour, a newly minted Nobel laureate explains what drives our biological clocks and what happens when they get out of sync with the clocks that are all around us. Also, working closely with Russia may not be at the top of the U.S. foreign policy agenda, but that's exactly what's happening in the science sphere. Get an update on the state of international science diplomacy. Then, an amateur astronomer has discovered the first comet outside our solar system. Hear why that's so exciting. And a new weather satellite that's expected to improve extreme weather forecasts. First, though, it's time for our monthly check-in with our friends at Nature News. On the line from Nature's headquarters in London is Anna Nagel. She's chief editor of Digital and Engagement. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been a little over 6 months since the March for Science. Back in April, March organizers said they were hoping that it wouldn't just be a one-day event, that it would be the start of a lasting movement. And we got some news about that on the six-month anniversary, which then reopened a whole bunch of controversy about the March for Science. So where do things stand at this point?
It did. So towards the end of October, a group of current and former volunteers, they actually posted an open letter to the US March for Science group. And they were accusing the group of secrecy, of being insensitive to the concerns of its members and generally no longer acting as the kind of grassroots movement that it was perceived as back in April.
And has there been a response from the March for Science?
In some ways, so some of the concerns that the volunteers were voicing were enough to make some of them walk away. And one of the largest satellite groups in New York has severed ties entirely with the group. So there were concerns about financial transparency, for example. So over $1 million has been raised this year by the group. And the people who wrote the open letter were questioning what had happened to it. Well, the accounting had been around that. Some of the volunteers had been asked to sign non-disclosure agreements, which they weren't keen on. And there were some questions around hiring and generally kind of sidelining some of the concerns that the members had about how science and how it relates to justice and discrimination and that kind of thing. The group has responded saying that they welcome concrete feedback and they've reaffirmed their commitment to increasing transparency, but there are still some questions among the volunteers who have sort of voiced their concerns.
Yeah, clearly one to keep watching. On the actual doing of science front, it seems like there's barely been a week this year when we haven't heard about this gene editing technology, CRISPR. The latest news appears to be a tweak of the gene editing technology that's used that makes it more precise, but also more widely applicable. So what have they done with it?
You're not wrong. It barely a week goes by that CRISPR doesn't make it into a headline somewhere over here. So the latest really exciting sort of advance has been two research groups have now come up with these new techniques that mean it's now possible to individually replace all four bases of DNA selectively.
And I mean, CRISPR has previously been described as actually being really precise and really important tool. But now some people are saying, oh, well, the old version was really more like a machete, not like scissors or a scalpel. It's hard to know what to think. How great is this now and how great, I guess, wasn't it before?
It's really being hailed as quite a major breakthrough. So it is much more precise. You're right. I think the previous original CRISPR system was hailed as this enormous breakthrough. And there's been so much research done in the last sort of 18 months, 2 years that regularly is now coming out, just improving it step by step. The original system is now being compared to like using a machete to remove a wart. And this latest system is more like precision chemical surgery. So it means that it's now possible for researchers to attempt to correct more than half of all human genetic diseases because it can undo the most common types of point mutation that involve a single sort of problematic base in your genome.
Of course, there's a lot of interest in trying to use this to treat human diseases, to be able to patent and potentially commercialize this technology. And that's meant a huge patent fight, actually, ongoing. Does this new version change or advance where that patent fight stands in any way?
I don't think the latest research plays into the patent battle, but there has been some developments in that recently. It really is a long-running patent battle. Usually some of these patent fights in science get sort of settled relatively quickly, but both sides of this argument have really invested for the long haul because of the potential returns long-term and what the technology could mean. So at stake are really the intellectual property rights to use the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing system in plants and animals, and that includes the technique to using the technique to treat human genetic diseases, which could be incredibly lucrative. So the Broad Institute and the University of California at Berkeley have now set the stage for the second round of oral arguments that are expected early next year. And the latest sort of chapter in this was a filing from the Broad Institute essentially saying that its opponent in this case has failed to provide any new evidence that would undermine the legitimacy of their patent, because they were awarded the initial one despite filing after Berkeley because they went for an expedited review process. So it's quite messy and quite vitriolic, but kind of fascinating to watch.
I'm talking with Anna Nagel. She's the chief editor of digital and engagement for the journal Nature. All right. Also on the genetics front, human genetics researchers recently gathered in Orlando, Florida for an annual conference. And one of the hot topics, I guess, was mental illness, not just the genes that could be responsible for specific illnesses, but actually how they might have evolved and why mental illness maybe hasn't been weeded out by the process of evolution so far. So what were some of the ideas there?
So it was interesting. So now the researchers are really starting to look at the role of evolution in mental illness and how those genetic underpinnings might have changed over time. And that's really become more possible with the advent of these massive human genome databases that mean we can look for connections between mental illness, the environmental and societal conditions that might have driven their emergence and their development. So I can give you a couple of examples of some of the things that were presented at that American Society of Human Genetics meeting. So for example, with schizophrenia, so many of schizophrenia's symptoms like auditory hallucinations or jumbling sentences, they involve brain regions that are quite tied to speech. So it might be that the ability to speak over the course of evolution outweighed that small risk that the genes involved could occasionally malfunction and result in schizophrenia.
So let's end on a slightly lighter note here. Everybody loves dinosaurs, right? There have actually been a number of recent headlines from the dinosaur research world, but one really caught my eye, literally. It's a reconstruction of the coloration of a feathered dinosaur called Cynoceropteryx. I mean, first of all, how can they possibly know what color the feathers of a dinosaur were? And then why is that important?
Everyone does love a dinosaur, and particularly this one. There's some awesome pictures of it floating around. So, yes, the Cynoceropteryx has been around for a while, and we've had a few pieces of research that have come out on it. So we knew it was the first dinosaur known to have feathers. And then in 2010, it became one of the first to have their colours unpicked. We found that it had this lovely ginger and white striped tail. And now what they've done is they've gone back to three fossils from 124 million years ago, and that had impressions of feathers and traces of pigmentation that had been preserved. So they've used that to help now elucidate the pattern of coloration on the Cynoceropteryx.
And what did they find? I mean, you said there's this stripy tail. There's what's been described as almost a raccoon-like pattern on the face with kind of a mask, again, this ginger and white. But then some of the interest is actually in the more subtle coloration differences on the body.
Exactly. So we knew it had this stripy tail, and we've now discovered that it has this band across its face like a raccoon, but also that it was countershaded. So it was dark on top and light underneath. And that is giving us some hints as to the kind of habitat that it might have lived in.
Anna Nagel is the chief editor of digital and engagement for the journal Nature. Anna, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.